Thank you for tuning in to the Head Game Podcast, powered by Mindful Athlete Training, where you grab an inside look into the heads and minds of the high performer. Learn what they do and how they think to help you take control of your own head game.
Welcome to another episode of The Head Game, powered by Mindful Athlete Training. Today we talk about the mental injury, what it is, how we can treat it, and how we can prevent it. In addition, we're going to be talking about the mental trainer and how that can help you improve your mental fitness. Sit back, relax, and enjoy another episode of The Head Game.
So how did those Clydesdales end up in, you know, in your neck of the woods?
I don't know. It's like a victory tour. It's like a rock band. I know that they've gone other places, and you know, it's an absolute spectacle, and people travel to see it because these animals are so majestic, and their personalities, you know, everyone was joking about like, who's going to hold the football for them to kick the extra point. You know, harkening back to the football ad that got, and they've had some award-winning commercials, you know, with the farmers, you know, that they're conversing over on the side, and they, you know, when they kick it, the other one leans in and says they usually go for two.
Right.
You know, it's a total, but the way that they travel, the way that they show up, the things that they, just kind of elicit in you, they're celebrities.
The size and demeanor of them just kind of take over the space.
Oh, again, you don't really truly appreciate how large they are. Clydesdales are up front, up close, I should say, and personal. And when there's eight of them and they're chugging along, it's just, you know, it's impressive, but, yeah, it just kind of got me thinking, you know, because we talk about, you know, how society embraces grandiose things, yep. Why we like to watch, why we attend, what do we spend our good money on? And, you know, it's relevant.
Yeah, I was this weekend I was playing basketball over at just a local LA Fitness with some buddies, and there was somebody there. He was 38 years old, probably looked like he was 25. And just solid muscle, was a brick. And he was just beating up. And so today I woke up and not as young as I used to be, and my back's hurting a little bit. And it's a little bit more inflamed than it used to be. And definitely feeling it today. And so it got me thinking about just kind of pain and my back and how I've been taking care of myself over the past few years. And really, you know, how I take care of myself, and am I doing that proactively, reactively, et cetera. And really what it looks like too, as you grow and change throughout your development, and because I made it such a priority throughout my playing career of taking care of my body and myself. And a lot of times we talk about, you know, taking care of the mind. So I thought today would be a good time to kind of talk about, you know, what happens when people are injured physically and what does a mental injury potentially look like for people?
I think that's a great question. You know, I go right to the mental injury is the most noticeable when it seems like the most amount of people are watching. And because that's when we really assign the most value to it, when it impacts an outcome. It's also very similar to nobody's paying attention to most of those people all along the way in their success journey, when they clearly have failed, made mistakes, but we don't assign as much value to it because it's not impacting the bottom line that we assign value to, like the NBA playoffs, the NHL playoffs. Baseball is, you know, coming into their summer season. So we don't assign much value to that versus imagine sitting down and watching a Major League Baseball playoff game in October. Mm-hmm. Where literally every single pitch matters. So when you talk about physical versus mental, I think the physical injury is identified visually. We see people labor. We see them taped up. We see them hobble. We have to assign a reason in our own mind as to why they're not performing up to par. Look at Joel Embiid, right? Torn ligaments in his thumb. Fractured orbital, concussion, Reportedly was in bed, I think, for 5 or 6 straight days, missed the first 2 games of the playoff series. As he returns, we're hoping, we're wanting to see that MVP performance, because that's the experience that we want as fans. But if he doesn't, you know, play up to snuff, we have to attribute a reason why. Well, he's injured, mm-hmm. right? So it's a justification. But I rarely see a time when we would ever do that mentally, unless someone makes a statement about how they're anxious or they're depressed or they need to take time off. So now it's more of that bottom line impact. Mm-hmm. It's those personal things that we see people go through that really makes us sit up and pay attention.
So really, until it's affecting performance of some kind or the bottom line, the mental isn't really in existence unless somebody is overtly bringing that up as a sense and they have to pull themselves out of something, or it's affecting their performance underlying. That's not really talked about in a way. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think it's not talked about because I think it's threatening to a lot of people, because it's something that is still too obscure, too abstract for a lot of people to put their finger on. Because if you think about the shock value that is assigned to the physical part of an injury, it's something that we see, it's something that we watch unfold, and they're not performing the most fundamental ways that we've gotten conditioned to as observers. But when there's the mental injury, it really is the silent victim of the person who is enduring that mental injury. And society encourages keep it to yourself. Society encourages don't talk about it. That'll be construed as weakness. That'll be identified as you not being as credible or as strong. Well, we've talked to professional athletes about this in our own work, and it's true.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're talking about almost that silence. Your injury is your own versus I think nowadays it's been you have other people to support you if there's a physical injury, where mental injury has for a long time been it's my own. It's something that I'm going through. It's something that I'm dealing with. And there's a lot of personal onus on it to take care of it, to measure it, to manage it. And you don't always have the resources or the tools or the know-how, especially if you're not reaching out to people. So it's a really interesting topic that you're saying, like that societal view of sometimes it's yours, it's on you, where a physical injury sometimes is on a larger team.
Right.
Versus just you, and you have to burden the whole. Obviously, there's still, I think, a mental component to physical rehab and also care. But I think there's a component that is much more isolating, much more individualized when it comes to the mental injury.
Take gambling, for instance, and you talk about the point spread and the injury reports that come out every week, impacting the amount of money that's being bet. When you think about the global impact that physical injury has on our expectation of performance, it's literally built into the equation. So imagine us sitting around saying, hey, I don't know, you know, that Ben Simmons, you know, what's the spread? Oh yeah. You know, he's mentally not going to be bringing his best game. We all know that. So, you know, you get with it. Those conversations don't exist. They happen afterwards.
They're much more rare.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're much more rare afterwards, though that must have affected him compared to, you know, fantasy football. You're talking about really as well with the gambling aspect or the books is, oh, we have the IR. Who's going to be on the IR? Who's active? Who is probable? Who is out this week? And that's going to dictate the decisions that you make on a higher level scale. So you're paying even as a fan, not just as a player, but or an athlete or a coach or an organization, but as the fans itself, you're paying full attention to people's physical well-being. But there's not a lot of things that you're talking about in terms of, hey, what's the mental state this person has? Maybe there's few conversations with that, significantly less than the physical. That's for sure.
When I first started my dissertation research, which really was kind of the spark for bringing mindfulness into pain response, attentional style, It was a lot of those different factors. I tracked injuries at the Division I football letter of grade 1, 2, and 3 plus and plus plus. So imagine for just a moment that we did that on a mental fitness scale. we actually sat down. I met with all the players. I evaluated them with baseline metrics before their preseason started. And then through the sports medicine department, I tracked their grade 1, 2, or 3 plus or plus plus injuries over the course of 5 months. And from that data, did a correlative analysis as to whether or not someone's ability to shift attention, pain, and response correlates with how well they can actually manage pain on the field. And I did a predictive, right, you know, analysis. I did that 15 years ago. Imagine what we would be like in the capacity of discussing what we're now identifying as the mental injury as mental trainers, that we're just talking about what someone's, you know, mental strength looks like that day. What's their endurance? What's their recovery or flexibility? What are the factors that we know resonate the most that impact player performance on the bottom line the most consistently? Imagine for us to be talking about those in such an open space that those are like any other factors. Whether that's a bad elbow, whether that's a bad shoulder, that's going to impact their ability to shoot.
Yeah, I think about what do we do, right? What can we do? And I think about the analogous to like the mental trainer. Mm. I thought the addition of a mental trainer into a team is really interesting because they've been around for a good amount of time and they've been included more and more, especially as injury has increased or awareness of injury has increased, especially with concussion, you can even think about. But again, physical injury has always been a part of any game, especially the football, basketball, et cetera. So there always been a personal trainer thinking about the physical and how we treat it. And typically at the college level, you don't just have one trainer for an entire school. You typically have a few trainers that are servicing maybe 2 to 3 teams, maybe sometimes even one team if the team is large enough or the university or college is large enough. And you have a trainer who is taking care of that person's physical well-being. And you don't just have the physical trainer, you have the personal trainer who's doing strength and conditioning. You also have the nutritionist, right? You also have a team doctor at times, depending on the size of the school or the budget of that school. But typically, trainers, even at a lower tier level, there's always going to be multiple personal trainers in terms of, I'm talking about rehab, I'm talking about stretching, I'm talking about, you know, taping ankles, et cetera, that are always a part of the team. They're embedded into the team. And they're not just there when something occurs. They're there if something occurs, but they're also there in a proactive way. So what does that do? Like having a athletic trainer as part of staff, what does that allow for in terms of people's view of the physical?
It totally normalizes the support is what it does. Like, you know, I had bad ankles at the end of my high school career. So I went from a small prep school to Division I football, and I got both of my ankles taped every single day for every single practice and game for 4 years. So my mentality shifted from a reactive to a proactive approach of, I'm going to get my ankles taped because that's what I need to do to make sure that my performance is at its absolute highest when I need it the most. The mental trainer normalizes the value of mental skills training, the role that mental fitness can play, the capacity of performance, not from a reactive stance of, hey, there's a problem or their performance is dipping. They need to go off and work with someone and kind of keep it, you know, versus let's talk about the variables that we all know are relevant to that strength, endurance, flexibility, recovery, that are going to impact practice with deliberate intention every single day. It's a normalization.
Yeah. So you're saying you think that a team should have more mental trainers similar to the physical trainer.
Absolutely. Of course they should. It's the
support system that they have.
It's the $1 billion industry, right? And
right. Yeah, they have, you know, if you think about PT or you think about physical recovery, you know, I used to use a heating pad every day before I would play on my lower back just to warm it up.
I did the ice bath. We talked about that.
Yep. And I think that's important. You talked about the ankle tape. You know, there's rolling out, right? That's breaking up, you know, that you know, IT band, loosening that up. There's stim, there's Graston, which is kind of loosening up that soft tissue. Cupping, which was kind of big with Michael Phelps.
Yeah, he made that very popular. He went public with that, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, you could see the legitimate bruises that physically causes bruises on your body and what that actually causes. But there's a rehab to that, and there's a purpose to that. So it's actually causing physical harm to some degree to create a recovery stance. And Graston's very same. It's actually very painful because you're breaking up that tissue and you're willing to go through that pain to get to that recovery as well. There's kinesio tape, which Luka Doncic is using right now in the NBA, famously.
So you got all of these strategies, all of these techniques, all of these compensatory contributing agents to performance in a physical capacity. You're talking about muscles. You're talking about bringing in additional materials like tape. We're talking about which some look like bruising, but I think cupping is more a circulatory benefit for recovery, right? There's all of this science behind what we're doing physically. Why do you think there's such a delay with the lack of science talking about how we can proactively assist with the mental piece?
It's a lack of buy-in and a lack of awareness too. And it's been this element where probably for the last, I would say 30 years, maybe starting in late 1990s, really, the mind has really been this obscure thing that hasn't been talked about. It's typically reactive. It's typically the obscure. You know, you think about the ancients in terms of like, typically if there's a psychological aspect, sometimes those people become the shamans, but sometimes those people are the outcasts, right? Whenever there was a mental challenge or a mental kind of deviation, those individuals were typically, you know, seen as crazy. Or something that would be wrong with them. Typically, that's not necessarily supported. And even as you mentioned years ago, right, you were at a football event and you were at training camp one time and you were witnessing a sports psychologist walking in the field and everybody on the team walked from one end zone all the way over to the other side because they didn't want to even be near or associated with that. And so there's this huge stigma that's around it of what the mental means. I think going back to the individualization, it's kind of something I have to deal with. And if you're not dealing with it by yourself, you're not tough, right? So it's that mentality that I think comes with the toughness, the stigma that's around it. But in terms of the adoption of the mental trainer, I think there's a few things. I think it comes down to resources. I think universities aren't necessarily applying resources to the mental, even though that costs them more money probably than the physical itself, especially with the growing trend of high-level athletes injuring themselves or potentially pulling themselves out of events or opportunities. So that's something that we need to be more aware of. The other aspect of besides resources and buy-in really is that normalization. It's having a trainer on every team. Or a trainer to every three teams. I think there's a huge value in that of normalizing the proactive approach and not the reactive approach, because a lot of universities now are starting to adopt the reactive elements. They are bringing in sports psychologists, they're bringing in psychologists to support the schools, but typically it's one, maybe two, to address 360 plus athletes. And that's obviously not going to be able to service what's necessary. So a buy-in needs to occur that's going to affect the masses more, but it's going to normalize it, because if they're constantly there, just like a personal trainer would be or a physical trainer would be, that's normalizing, hey, if something is going on, I need to make sure I go to it, or I can go there just proactively too to make sure that my ankles are taped to support myself, right, et cetera. So there needs to be some type of catalyst, and hopefully it's encouraging what's going on in society right now, what's going on at college level as well. What can go on at the corporate level as well, that there needs to be a more proactive endeavor and approach to taking care of your mental, just like a mental trainer would be.
I can't agree with you more that there needs to be a catalyst. You know, I'm sitting here listening and thinking about that. But you know where my head goes, though, Hunter, which I'm concerned about, which I think of Corey Stringer. You remember Corey Stringer? Does that name sound familiar to you?
It does sound familiar, but I forget the story.
Corey Stringer was an offensive lineman for the Minnesota Vikings who died from heat stroke. Hmm. He was a very, very large lineman, well over 300 pounds. And his internal core temperature, I think, hit about 108 or 109 on the field. And amazingly so, it was then brought to light that the NFL did not have a heat stroke protocol on the sidelines in camp. And for that reason, and lawsuits and ugliness and real traumatic impact, there was a complete movement. There was a total shift. And I'm going to make analogous to that for just a moment some of the more recent student athlete suicides that have been brought to light in the national media, of the pressure that student athletes are under, the value that we assign to perform at the highest level, younger and younger and younger. Athletes are almost expected to commit to a singular sport, younger and younger and younger, because that's the path for success. So yes, I think there needs to be a catalyst, but I'm concerned that because the physical is so visually obvious that we assign attention to that, but the mental injury is still lurking, hiding in the shadows. I just don't want there to be more traumatic impact, loss of life, serious mental illness issues that need to sometimes shake that tree of change in order for people that are the decision makers to stand up and say, enough. We're going to assign a mental trainer to every team, every three teams. We're going to find the expense. We're going to find the personnel. We're going to make the resources available, because everyone knows at the highest level, when you're in that room and you're having that intimate conversation, that mental and physical are exactly the same. There is no difference. They cannot be treated as one. They need to be treated on the same plane.
I think the biggest thing too, and just a little bit of kind of change management theory of what you're talking about too, is we're talking about this catalyst, and we're talking about something that dramatic is typically required to make those changes. And I think the challenge is people. The challenge comes with people, because I think there's a lot of times where you can show them all the variables, why it makes sense, why it's valuable, why it will be supportive, why it would even affect the bottom line sometimes. But I think there's an emotional piece for people in leadership, that there is the stigma of thought surrounding it, that there's a resistance to it, that there's a belief system that we can't do it, we can't find that money, the can't mentality at times. And I think we sometimes those very large catalysts hit the emotional cord to protect themselves, or to what I mean by that is, if something tragic happens, it's, that's bad, but it's, we have to protect the university, we have to protect the college, we have to protect ourselves or organization. So then you make the change. So I think there always has to be something that is hitting the emotional cord to make those change, which is terrible, because that's not a proactive approach. It's not seeing the future. It's not saying, well, I'm being mindful of the things that can occur, and even how I can be most supportive of my students, my athletes, my organization, my employees. So I think there needs to be some emotional chord that is struck, and it's, how do you strike that chord without the tragedy? How do you strike that chord without a significant catalyst? And I think that's the largest challenge, to make a large scale change for people, the large adaptation, is people need to be emotionally affected in a way that they're willing to make that change, that they're willing to concede at other times, that they're willing to support themselves. Because I think more and more that data is showing, when you incorporate mental, your people are better off. They tend to have less burnout. They tend to perform at a higher level. You can see that with changes in scheduling, right? The 4-day work week that's been kind of talked about.
They're just more balanced.
You talk about support systems. You talk about like a Google or something like that, that's the happiest place to work because they're incorporating mental aspects into it. There's a reason why they're happier, and the productivity is still high. So it's about finding ways that people can start adopting that, or finding new ways to be effective. You know, I think about, I talk a lot about like engineering stuff. And one thing I talk about is solar panels. It's like renewable energy makes a lot of sense, right? Even if fossil fuels work better or cheaper, eventually you do run out. So you need to have a renewable source eventually. It doesn't matter when, but eventually you will need a renewable source. And the adaptation or the adoption of like solar is just starting to really become a thing because the price is dropping, right? And so once that price finally becomes comparable, everything makes sense. Having solar makes sense. It's renewable. It's resource given. It's actually over the course of time, it's cheaper because you can actually make money by having reserve energy. You could sell that back to the grid. But until it actually hits your bottom line, until it affects you in an emotional cord, you're not going to adopt it. So it's the same thing. I think there needs to be something that is an easier model for people to adopt, right? The mental trainer, I think, is a model that people can accept. And I think it's finding ways to incorporate that in. You need to make it cheaper. You need to make it scalable. That's the way in which change happens at a faster rate.
Yeah, I've said before, and if you break down change into digestible, manageable pieces or steps, it becomes a simpler process. And I think that process of simplicity is the most advisable, especially when we want stages of change to become more progressive. When we're talking about the decisions maker, when we're talking about real monetary investment, it doesn't have to be out of tragedy. It doesn't have to be stemming from trauma. But I think the mental injury and trainer that addresses that injury through education, through conversation, becomes normalized. There needs to be more discussion, more promotion, more analysis that makes sense. And fortunately, you know, we all know when people in higher positions start to really open up and talk, and this is happening at more of a granular level, but it's happening slowly. It's not happening fast enough, where big time athletes or entertainers or people in the media are starting to come out with their story to make it more personal. That's how you expedite the process of change. That's how you make it a simpler process. You make it more approachable to the masses if it's personalized from the people that we've got eyes on the most.
Yeah. And it also has to be the right way to do it too. And I say the right way to do it, not that there's one way to do it, but I think it has to be approached in the right way. I think right now, the current approach would be, hey, let's give some people support so that if something goes wrong, they can go and talk to this person. I think that's been the current approach. Or, hey, you know what? You've been dealing with a lot lately. Let's take you out of it. Let's remove you from it for a while till you get better. I think there needs to be more of an approach to making it just something that's part of your daily work. A sports psychologist had to come on my team. We lost a teammate, actually, in between my sophomore and junior year. He was actually my roommate. And we lost him tragically over the summer. So when we came back, our coach brought in a sports psychologist. This person was actually not a part of the school at the time. This person actually came in externally to support us, right? So we're not even getting this person initially from the school. It was brought in externally. And she would sit in during our practice. So while we were practicing, she would just be sitting in a chair in the corner. And if we needed a moment, we would run over to her for 5 minutes. She would give us some tips, some tricks, and then we just joined back in practice. And my coach was a great at just being okay with that, accepting of that, that, hey, you know what? You need to just run over there, get some mental tips and come back in. And she was great at what she did. And we made it normalized. So when something more significant happened, we were able to go to her and talk to her for a longer period of time. But it just became a normal thing that we were much more mindful of our own abilities, but we also had the resource and tools. So that empowered us to be comfortable with, hey, we're dealing with this mental thing in the current moment. It allowed us to have a resource, a tool right at our disposal quickly, and allowed us to kind of jump back into practice versus it being this more extensive thing, right? A lot of times we talk about stress not turning to anxiety, grief or sadness not turning into depression. That's because it's being treated immediately. It's like if you roll your ankle, a trainer's running to you immediately. It's not like, oh, you know what? Let's wait a month or two, see what happens. And then maybe we go and treat it. It's no.
Yeah, gut it out.
They should be there immediately. Right. They should be there immediately to treat that so that, again, it's supportive. And that's, again, similar to that personal trainer. If they're there on site, they can treat it immediately, support it, so it's not becoming something worse.
I'll take it even one step further, though, analogous to your experience when you lost a teammate. Just a person being there, I can make the argument, gives the client, the athlete, permission emotionally to explore a little bit longer what's bothering them, because that trainer that is available to you gives you permission to feel a little bit longer, to ponder a little bit longer, which then increases the likelihood you're going to go take those 5 minutes, because that person is present. They're visually in your space. They're tangible. Mm-hmm. It needs to, the mental trainer for the mental injury needs to be more of a tangible exchange. That doesn't happen in our society. You don't see mental trainers on the bench. You're seeing them more often in Major League Baseball, which is now, along with golf, becoming that sport that is more supportive of the mental side. Again, in the research that suggests how often is the concept of mental coming up in key sports, you're looking at golf, you're looking at baseball, you're looking at gymnastics, because they're very individualized, focus-oriented moments that are encapsulated by 3-5 seconds at clips at a time. But if it's not tangible, if you're not seeing that person, who is that person? That's a mental trainer. They're here for specific reasons to help with strength, endurance, recovery, flexibility. Oh, that makes sense. So now it's in the back of my mind. It's giving me more of that reasonability that when there becomes a problem and I first start to feel it, I'm going to go approach that a hell of a lot sooner.
Yep. It's something that's constant. It's something that's always there. It normalizes it and it makes it much more effective.
Yeah, the injury and the trainer, right? If they always go hand in hand, right? It's the peanut butter and jelly. They fit well together, but now it's really just getting away from, well, that's a physical partnership. No. It needs to be, it's a mental partnership because the physical exists. The physicality is the tangible piece that we see with our eyes. We see movement, we see action, but understanding that there's a whole nother level of performance that's going on behind the curtain that is the mental relationship between the injury and the trainer. That's what needs to be celebrated.